So we are starting a series on Daniel. And Daniel is was a prophet in the Old Testament. There's some interesting background to it, but I won't get into it so that I can finish on time and set the bar for Peter next week. So Daniel has 12 chapters. And we're going to be looking at it in 12 weeks. There are going to be some breaks in there, and we'll end the beginning of April. And the book of Daniel is interesting because it records, well, it's named Daniel, and it records events from Daniel's life and from his perspective. It's almost like when you read it, you know, like you can have books that are written like Kings and Chronicles, where it's clearly someone from the outside writing about the individuals. But Daniel has the tone of, if Daniel didn't write it, he was talking to the reporter, you know, and the reporter was saying, well, tell me about, and Daniel told him, and the reporter wrote down exactly what Daniel said. So it wasn't outside comments by a historian looking in on Daniel's life. This is really from Daniel's perspective. So, we're just going to jump in. Daniel, yes. Could you hand this out? Just seems appropriate. Please turn in your Bible to Daniel, but I'm also, Daniel is handing out Daniel chapter 1 in the NET version, which is what I'm going to be reading from, just so that you can be aware of both. It's always good to be looking at it in your own Bible, but at the same time, sometimes it's easiest to be able to look at exactly what I'm reading. So, Daniel chapter 1. So we're just going to jump right in and kind of let the book introduce itself. So the plan for this morning is we're going to go through chapter 1, reading it in blocks, with some comments and observations, just so we really understand what's happening in Daniel 1. And then how does that connect to us, and then introduce a series? So we're going to start the series without introducing it. We'll do that at the end. Let's start. Okay, Daniel chapter 1. Starting at verse 1. So, in the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon advanced against Jerusalem and laid it under siege. Now the Lord delivered King Jehoiakim of Judah into his power, along with some of the vessels of the temple of God. He brought them, so the vessels being like special treasures, implements, and so on from the temple treasury. He brought these to the land of Babylonia, to the temple of his god, and put the vessels in the treasury of his god. So, the immediate context is it's 605 BC. Thanks, Daniel. So it's 605 BC. King Nebuchadnezzar has just taken over from his father. He's just been crowned king. His father died, and he took a quick trip, it appears, back to Babylon to be crowned king. And he came back to Jerusalem. And Babylon has recently overtaken Assyria as the world power. And simultaneously, it defeated Egypt as well. So Babylon has just become the world power at the time, defeating Assyria and Egypt. And Jerusalem, he comes to Jerusalem, and there's a lot of background to why he came to Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is the capital city, originally capital city of Israel, but Israel was divided, and now Jerusalem is the capital city of the southern part of Judah. Okay, so let's get a big picture on this. Where did my marker go? We're going to get a big picture on where we are at. So we're going to look at very briefly at the history of Israel. So you can see this is a timeline, and you can't see it, but that's okay. I'm going to put some dots here. So this is roughly 2200 BC. These are in 400-year blocks. Okay, 2200 BC, Abraham is born. That's really when it started. 400 years later, Joseph dies. Okay, another 400 years later, and Joshua is leading Israel into the Promised Land. So that's about 1400 BC. Another 400 years later, King David becomes king. Another 400 years later brings us essentially to where we are right now. And Jerusalem falls to Nebuchadnezzar. And I'll just mention two other. This is breaking the rule. This is 200 years, so half. About 200 years later, the Jews actually come back to Israel and finally settle. There were a number of waves of coming back, but finally, about 400 BC, a little before that, the wall was built, temple rebuilt, everything is in place, the law is functioning, and so on. And then another 400 years, and we're at 0 BC, roughly, and Jesus is born. So, so that kind of gives you a sense. And just to, I'm going to chart out sort of how the, I hate saying it this way, how the fortunes of Israel looked. So it started off with Abraham, and it was, I mean, he was nothing. He was just an individual, but he became something. You know, he became pretty powerful, and it leveled off there for a while with his sons, but, you know, like, by the time you got to Joshua, or to Joseph, they were something, you know, like they were a significant force in Egypt. So this is kind of a high point. It didn't last long because the Egyptians, after Joseph died, they forgot about him, and things went really bad, okay? Because they became, basically, they became slaves. And for hundreds of years, that's what they were locked into, okay? Until God surprised them with Moses and Joshua, and suddenly things got dramatically better. They came to the land, and suddenly they were a nation in the land of Israel, just as God had promised back here. So now, it didn't go really well. Like, as you know, the judges were kind of like up and down. You know, there were good times and there were bad times. And it probably ended up more bad times. But once you got to Saul and then David, things really started to improve. Like, with David, Israel became a world power. Like, no one could stand against David. And by the time you got to Solomon, like, it was a nation that the whole world could look in on and learn from. So this was a high point. But after Solomon, it changed very drastically. The nation was split, and I'm not going to kind of chart that out, but the nation was divided, you know, into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. So Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And it went up and down. There were good kings and there were bad kings. And about 100 years before this, Israel, the northern kingdom, was taken away by the Assyrians, and their land was taken over and parceled out, and it just got all messy. With Judah, it came later, but things went downhill pretty rapidly. And what happened is there were three times that Nebuchadnezzar came back and attacked Jerusalem. And over the course of about 20 years, it probably plunged to the lowest point that it had ever been. I mean, here they were slaves, but here they went from being like truly significant to being nothing. They were, you know, completely taken over, taken out of the land, like just bits and pieces people left in. And things did improve, but I won't get into that. All that to say, this is where Daniel is. Daniel is in the lowest place that perhaps Israel has ever been. I mean, they had done well. So you've got, here, let me just, so you have Joshua, you have David, you have Egypt, and here you have Babylon. Here you have, oh, sorry, that's not Joshua, that's Joseph and Joshua. Anyway, so just to give you a sense of where are we at in the whole picture of Israel. Current events. So the more current picture, so the last 100 years, so just think about the people who are living. 100 years, that would bring us back to World War I for us. 100 years ago, so if you imagine that we're in Judah, we look back 100 years ago, our brothers and sisters in the north were taken away by Assyria. Since that time, we've had three major kings ruling over us. And all of them ended with a twist. Okay, so first of all, there was Hezekiah. He was the king at the time of when the Assyrians came and took over Israel. He was a good king. And there were some exciting, scary, but exciting times. Like, it was under Hezekiah that the Assyrians came and they surrounded us in Jerusalem. And he prayed, and that night the angel of the Lord killed 185,000 soldiers in the Assyrian army. Like, that started the downfall of the Assyrian Empire, right there, one night, because one person prayed. Like, that was big. But Hezekiah kind of ended with a twist. You know, he didn't end in the best way. There was pride and so on. Then his son Manasseh was the next king, and he was an evil man. In fact, Prophet Isaiah, who was working during the time of Hezekiah and Manasseh, was probably put to death with Manasseh's approval. You know, tradition says I think he was sawn in half. So Manasseh did not rule over a very nice regime. Those were tough days if you wanted to stay on the right side of the law, so to speak. And then, but at the end, he repented. You know, so there was a kind of a twist to Manasseh's life. And then Josiah, grandson of Manasseh, he was the one who became king at age 8. And he was the one who rebuilt the temple. The law was rediscovered. He was good. But his life ended with a twist, too. And you'd have to look at that, because he did this odd thing that actually got him killed. I'll leave that with you. And then there were three minor kings in there as well. All of them were wicked. Ammon, son of Manasseh. And then after Josiah, so those of us here, we would remember Josiah. Probably all of us were under Josiah's reign. And then Jehoaz, his son, only reigned for about 3 months. And then Jehoiakim has reigned for a couple of years. He's evil too. So you can see, if we're living in Jerusalem at that time, these have been pretty turbulent times. You know, world politics have been shifting. We've gone from Assyria to Babylon and Egypt. You know, like, those are some pretty big forces that we're tussling. We've had just in the past few years, some pretty, a lot of leadership shifts, and it has been confusing. But it hasn't just been a problem with our leaders. The prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah have showed that there are deep heart problems among us. Even when kings were good, the prophets were still saying, there's something wrong with your heart. And so what came about is, like it says here, it says, God handed us over to King Nebuchadnezzar. This is what the prophets had warned. This is in line with what the original covenant that God had given through through Moses. So if you look back to Deuteronomy 28, it talks about how if you go this course, God says, I will actually take you out of the land. And so he's just doing what he said he would do. At the same time, Israel was never meant to be here. We were meant to be the, you might say, the megaphone through which God shouts to the world and says, this is who I am. And this is where we are now. In a sense, God's reputation has through us been dragged through the mud. Like the temple was his home. That was where he lived. You want to go meet with God? You go to the temple. And a foreign power has gone in and taken God's stuff out of his temple and is now displaying it in an idol temple. Like God's reputation has, because of us, been dragged through the mud. This is not the best of times. But it wasn't just material possessions that were taken. So in verse 3, there's more. So Nebuchadnezzar took the treasures, but then the king commanded Ashpenaz, who is in charge of his court officials, to choose some of the Israelites who were of royal and noble descent, young men in whom there were no physical defect and who were handsome, well-versed in all kinds of wisdom, well-educated, and having keen insight, and who are capable of entering the king's royal service, and to teach them the literature and language of the Babylonians. So the king assigned them a daily ration from his royal delicacies and from the wine he himself drank. They were to be trained for the next 3 years. At the end of that time, they were to enter the king's service. So he didn't just take treasures, he took the cream of the crop. He took the very best of our young men. Perhaps it was to train them and they would come back and rule. Maybe it was in some way to sort of smooth our integration into his empire. But it was sort of like 3 years of university training. It was to, these young men were, their identity was going to be reshaped. Their thinking, their language, it was indoctrination. They were going to be remade. But it came with perks. They would eat at the same palace cafeteria as the king did. So there's a prestige. There's sort of a sense that he was buying them, you know? So he was changing them and buying them. And as it turned out, among these young men were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But the overseer of the court officials renamed them. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, Hananiah he named Shadrach, Mishael he named Meshach, and Azariah he named Abednego. I don't know if I pronounced those right. Anyway, so the names start to tell us that these are real people who were affected. And the renaming just adds to the indoctrination of them. Their names before had all meant something highlighting God, you know, so it tells you something perhaps of the families that they had come from. Their names emphasize who God is and their confidence in him and his greatness. The new names that were given all in some ways compromise that, shifting from God honoring to idol honoring. So just to Micah, Can you stand up for a second? Okay. So most likely, so Micah's 15, right? Okay, I remember. Most likely, Daniel and his three friends were Micah's age, okay? Because, I mean, who knows? They might have been Daniel's age, but But it, often, like I was reading something about how the education for the Babylonians really focused on, you know, starting at age 14 to 15. So just imagine Micah. Sorry, I kind of left you standing there, didn't I? But think about Micah, okay? We're invaded by, and put whatever foreign power you want. Canada is invaded. They take the best of the best, so they take Micah. How do you like that? He experiences the trauma of war and being taken away from everything that's familiar to him. His family, his home, his country. He's essentially made a slave. His name, Micah. Do you know what your name means? I do. Who is like God is what his name means. Am I right, Debbie? I am. And he's renamed something like who is like Darwin or who is like Hitler, or, you know, his name is completely turned around to something opposite. He's made to learn a new language. He learns the literature of whatever country has enslaved him and captured him. It's systematic cultural retraining, but there are also perks. He gets food and clothes and fancy apartment and career possibilities. He's set up on social media with the latest cell phone and unlimited high-speed data. okay, so do you see the mix that there is? Like, he loses everything, but he's given everything. Like, can you imagine the pressures on him? One of the interesting things is, in verse 6, it says, as it turned out, among these young men were some from Judah. There's a hint there that it wasn't just Micah and three of his friends. It looks like there were others too. So let's see what happened. So we're seeing only a part of the Jewish captives. So verse 8, how does Daniel respond? But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the royal delicacies or the royal wine. He therefore asked the overseer of the court officials for permission not to defile himself. Then God made the overseer of the court officials sympathetic to Daniel. But he responded to Daniel, I fear my master the king. He is the one who has decided your food and drink. What would happen if he saw that you looked malnourished in comparison to the other men your age? If that happened, you would endanger my life with the king. Daniel then spoke to the warden, whom the overseer of the court officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Please test your servants for 10 days by providing us with some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who are eating the royal delicacies. Deal with us in light of what you see. So the warden agreed to their proposal and tested them for 10 days. So two things. One, he made up his mind. He resolved. Why? It was just food. Why did... And it was good food at that. I mean, perhaps because it was unclean food. You know, the Mosaic Law had quite a few restrictions on what you could eat, animals that could be eaten and couldn't. Maybe because it was sacrificed to idols. Maybe he just did not want to be dependent. I heard someone say once that, like, eating was a sign of friendship. And maybe it was a way of saying, no, I'm not going to align myself with the king. Or maybe he just didn't want to be bought. It probably is related mostly to the Mosaic Law, but it could have been a number of those things. But whatever it was, he was committed to some boundaries that he didn't want to step over. He would not step over. The second thing is, look at the wisdom and tact that with which he acted. So this isn't like an angry rebellion, you know, no hunger strike, he goes and he asks permission, and then he makes a proposal, you know? So he goes about it in a very tactful way. And interesting, he does it in two stages. So he goes first to the his boss's boss, and he asks permission. Surprisingly, the boss's boss doesn't say no. He says, almost like, I'd love to accommodate you, but here's the problem. Okay? So he doesn't say no, but he says, here's the problem. You know, like, if anything happened to you, I'm held responsible. I'm responsible for your health, and the king has chosen your food. Daniel, I can't. And then he goes to his boss, the warden, and he suggests a possibility. He says, well, what about testing us? And it's this is me reading between the lines, but it's almost like he says, I talked to the big boss, and he said, really the problem is I don't want you to, you know, get unhealthy. So what if it actually is good for us? Like, what do you think we try it? Who knows how he said it. But he said, can we try it? For 10 days. And here's the end result. And the warden said, sure, we'll try it for 10 days. Verse 15 says, at the end of the 10 days, their appearance was better and their bodies were healthier than all the young men who had been eating the royal delicacies. So the warden removed the delicacies and the wine from their diet and gave them a diet of vegetables instead. It worked. Being devout to the law, resolving, setting boundaries, being disciplined and principled, strong, bold, refusing to be bought and controlled, taking a risk, being wise and shrewd, tactfully negotiating. It worked. And if he was here, Daniel would interrupt me at that point, and he would say, excuse me, I think you're missing the point. You're making me sound like the hero, and that's not how I see it. Don't you see how I've presented my story all along? And you look back at how Daniel has reflected on events. Verse 2, it was God delivered Jehoiakim over. It wasn't because Nebuchadnezzar was so powerful and invincible. It was, from Daniel's perspective, because God handed the Israelites over. Verse 9, it was God who made the overseer sympathetic. It wasn't because Daniel was so smart. And do you think it was simply a healthy diet that made such a drastic improvement after only 10 days? I don't think so. I think Daniel's starting point, sort of the foundation, was simply that God was real and alive, and he's working. And I think we need to understand Daniel's actions in light of or in response to the God who is real and active. It's how to make sense of what Daniel did. So, for example, like the boundaries that he set, there can be many reasons for setting boundaries. Some are good and some might not be good. Boundaries are only as good as their anchors and their reasons. So it could have been that he said, I'm not stepping over this boundary because of stubbornness or devotion to the letter of the law, love for his parents, health concerns. And not that all of these are bad, but none are sufficiently good anchors in and of themselves. I think his boundary was built on a healthy fear of God who is living and active and who gave the law. This proposal was really taking a risk on God, in a sense giving space for God to work because God was living and active. So in a sense, he entrusted himself to God. See what God will do. He trusted himself to God and left it in God's hands. So what's the end result? Verse 17. Now, as for these four young men, God endowed them with knowledge and skill in all kinds of literature and wisdom, and Daniel had insight into all kinds of visions and dreams. When the time appointed by the king arrived, the overseer of the court officials brought them into Nebuchadnezzar's presence. When the king spoke with them, he did not find among the entire group anyone like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, or Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and insight the king asked them about, he found them to be 10 times better than any of the magicians and astrologers that were in his entire empire. So do you see how thoroughly God's blessing is seen? In the short term, in the 10 days, it was just health. God blessed him with health. Medium term, he blessed him with gifts. Long term, the way it's described is that the wisdom that God gave them and developed in them made them 10 times better than even their profs, you know, is kind of how it's written. So what can we learn from this? Like, how do we put our lives alongside Daniel? I think this is a theme that goes through the book of Daniel. I think the key starting point for Daniel was that simple reality that God is alive and active just as he promised. Just that. I could have said God is sovereign, and that's true, but sometimes when you put things in like a theological word box like that, you stop thinking about it. When you say God is alive and active just as he promised, it's like God is here. God himself is right in this room. The God of Daniel is here. It's the idea of Hebrews 11:6. Anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. It's not just that he's sovereign. It's that he's here. He is. And do you see how Daniel was confident in this in spite of appearances? God was more silent and hidden than anyone wanted him to be. This was not the best of times. This is not the times of Moses and David, you know. This was the low point. But the core was unchanged. And I get the sense that Daniel recognized that. He was focused on the unchanging core of God, and the times weren't good, but he didn't need to worry about fixing the times so he could be confident in God. He was confident in God regardless of what was happening in the times. It makes me think that what it reminds me of is Betsy Ten Boom. You know, Betsy Ten Boom thrived in the worst situation you can imagine. She was in a concentration camp. She had no rights, no freedom. She could not, and she thrived there because her God was unchanged. And I think for all of us, like I look back on COVID and I think that what it showed for all of us is we struggle to thrive when times aren't ideal. Maybe as a church, just we've become used to comfortable times and we can see how to thrive in the good times, but maybe we don't know how to thrive when times aren't good. And so for all of us, I think we're afraid, we're angry, but I don't think we thrived. The core had not changed. But I don't think we thrived in general as a church. So how will we thrive in economic collapse, severe persecution, or world war? Like, these are important things to learn, to live based on the core, not on how times appear. And it wasn't easy for Daniel. It's interesting. You know, the story doesn't talk about how hard it was for Daniel. You can look at David and others, and they will be more sort of transparent about, here's how hard it was. I sort of get the sense with Daniel that he says, you can imagine how hard it was for me, but you can't imagine how much God did. So I'm going to tell you what God did. You imagine the rest, and you'll be right about that. But you can't imagine what God did. The interesting thing is, even in his faith community of fellow Israelites, that it was challenging. Like I said, there were quite possibly others alongside of him who took a different route. Even going back to Jerusalem, it was challenging. There were more than enough people who said, faith in God is good, but we need to get with the times and deal with the political realities that surround us. You know, that was perhaps why Josiah went out to war and lost his life. There are others who said, religion needs to be reimagined for more modern times. We need to see what religious trends are out there. And that's what was happening in Jerusalem at the time. And maybe that's happening today too, some of those same things. And we lose that simple core that God is as alive and active as he has ever been. So because of this, Daniel did two things. Because God is alive and active, Daniel looked at his environment differently. He realized that it wasn't just food, even though everyone around him, including some of his peers and certainly many folks back home, would argue differently. He said, it's not just food. And I think for us too, our environment tells us about so many things. It's just, you know, our environment tells us what's normal, about what to eat, how to spend money, handle debt, date, raise children and grandchildren, spend time, leisure, pursue a career, retire, set priorities, make decisions, use our phone, social media, choose movies to watch, dress, lead others, deal with conflict. You know, like so many things, our environment tells us this is the normal way to do it. It's just this. And it's, but maybe these things aren't just little things. Maybe all of these things, we need to start with the idea that God is alive and active rather than just absorbing the messages that our environment gives us. I was listening to a Dave and B song. That goes back to when I was a teen. And it says, there are roads that take you everywhere, but where you need to go. There are roads that don't go anywhere, and one that leads you home. The way is rough and steep. It is the path to the one I seek, and I must go on. And he goes to say, I'll follow in the path, the man with the nail scars in his hand. It's interesting. In Daniel's day, some stumbled terribly because they were blind to the danger, and countless more, I think, just lived empty lives, falling short of what God had for them. It was more dangerous than they realized. And I think it is the same for us. Like, we do live in dangerous days. We've seen leaders stumble. It's dangerous. But maybe the greater danger is being seduced by the environment we're in and merely living empty lives. I think we're more easily deceived than we realize. And I know I've said it before, but it's been on my mind a lot. It struck me. Sorry, now I'm doing a Peter thing, aren't I? we're reading with the kids. We're reading a number of devotionals that go through historical Christians. And it's interesting how many of them had to go different than even many others, many of their Christian peers. You know, Mary Slessor was unusual among missionaries because she lived like the people she served. That was highly unusual. George Mueller was highly unusual because no one else was caring for the orphans. Menno Simons cared for his enemies, people who claimed to be Christians but had hurt him. He cared for them even though all the other Christians around them said, let them die. Hudson Taylor, same thing. You know, So anyway, the environment. And then secondly, because God is alive and active, Daniel did things differently. He asked permission to be different. He proposed a test. So what can you and I do differently because God is alive and active? The way of thinking of it, the way I was thinking about it is, what would I do differently if God was visibly here? Like, what would I do differently? Would it change a lot of things? It can change all sorts of things. It means I can respond kindly when I'm wronged by someone. I can come to him with my failure if he is really here. I can work in an imperfect church. We can face our worries. We can deal well with much or little. We can make difficult decisions. Like, what difference would it make if God was visibly here? What would you do if he was visibly here? What if we would ask ourselves that question often during the day? What if we would, even today, just do one thing simply because God exists and is working? What would that be? And the beautiful thing is, we have no idea what God might do with our small actions made because we are confident in him. So, ends off. Daniel lived until the first year of Cyrus the king. He lived long. If he went from his mid-teens, that would mean he'd easily be mid-80s when he died. Lived through at least 5 kings, 2 kingdoms. And he lived to see the start of people returning to the land of Israel. The book is written, I think, like an older person telling stories. He's not writing like a historian saying, okay, let me just give you a step-by-step. He says, let me tell you the things that really stand out in my mind. So he tells a number of stories, and he tells what's important. He tells those big moments when God revealed his plans to him. And so you'll see, as we go through, a mixture of big stories and big revelations from God. And I'll just end with this. It's not the best of times. It wasn't the best of times, but God was alive and active, like today. We see him working in one individual's life in some really challenging times. And in those very dark days, we see God outlining his plans and work more clearly than ever before. Isn't that interesting that dark times and God revealed more of his coming plan than he had up until then? Like, isn't that amazing how God works? I'd wanted to put this in and I didn't know where to put it, but I'll just mention it quickly and maybe Peter will say it better next week. But I think one of the things as we go through is to realize that we're also different than Daniel. I mean, Daniel knew God through the law. And so that was what he followed, what structured him. For us, we now know, we see what Daniel was looking ahead to. We know God through Jesus. It's Jesus who brings us to God. That's how we know him. Daniel followed the law. We follow Jesus. So all of a sudden, it becomes, in some ways, much broader, much bigger than it was for Daniel, much clearer, maybe even more challenging, too. But there's more resources there too. So we're different too. But let's learn from him. So Father, as we go into this series, help us to learn. Please equip us to function in the times that we're in right now. Please do through us all that you want to do. May we thrive in these days, because you are the same, and we never want to lose sight of that. Thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.